Hi everyone, Davinia here, and this season of Let's Make It Rain, the podcast, is sponsored by PensionBee, an online pension provider who's on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for a range of different needs, whether you're self-employed or want to invest responsibly with a fossil fuel-free or impact investing plan. Head to PensionBee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, for lots of us, we didn't start learning about how to save, spend, and invest our money for the future until we were well into our adulthood. I wrote Cash is Queen to change that. Cash is Queen is the world's first financial literacy book written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, equipping them with everything they need to build solid financial foundations long before they start their first jobs. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, your goddaughters, and even yourselves. Link in show notes to find out more. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today I'm excited to be joined by the wonderful Kimberly Wilson. Kimberly is a chartered psychologist specialising in the links between food, nutrition and mental health. She's also the author of two books, How to Build a Healthy Brain and Unprocessed. Kimberly, thank you so much for being here today. It's taken us such a long time to get this in the diary. Can you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Sure thing. Well, you kind of basically covered it. So I'm a psychologist. I have a master's degree in nutrition. And in that master's, I looked at the impact of food and nutrients on the brain. And really, I have tried to incorporate that both into parts of my clinical practice, but also in terms of my science communication to help people understand that, as well as all the other external things that we can do to help support our brain health and our mental health, nutrition should be one of those things. Thinking about how you eat and how it affects the structure and function of your brain should be a cornerstone of mental health, whether on an individual level or a wider policy social.
I love that. And we're going to get into that in more detail over the course of this conversation. One of the things that I love about your communication style is the way you so adeptly break down into plain English some of those different attributes of brain health and how nutrition plays a role, but in a way that doesn't ever feel overbearing or heavy, but just something that, you know, we feel that we can all easily apply into our day-to-day roles to make a contribution, which I think is the most important thing. But one of the things that I particularly like, and given the audience, the listenership for this podcast tend to be, you know, really creative, ambitious, entrepreneurial, often women, doing a multitude of different things with their careers and with their lives. And one of the questions that I get quite commonly within the Rainmakers Academy, you know, just thinking about the work that I do at Raincheck, is how can you combine all of these different strands of your identity, of your personality, of the things that we want to do in our lives, because we just feel we have no time, particularly as women, of course, I'm speaking about. But you have found a way to achieve what lots of us struggle with, which is combining two of your passions, food and psychology. How did that come about? Was that a career path that you knew was always available to you, or did you have to kind of feel your way and carve it out yourself?
Very much the latter. So when I started out, all I really knew was that I wanted to be a psychologist. I wanted to be a practitioner psychologist working with people. And so at the time that I started my training, there really wasn't any scope to think about food or nutrition within that kind of practice. And I started my career after doing, you know, training and placements in different settings, in schools, in kind of after school clubs and charities. I started my career proper in prison. And it was at that time when I was running a therapy service for the in-house NHS, when I came across, I was introduced to some research that looked at the impact of nutrition in prisons on the prison population, and found that when you improve nutrition, and in the case of the papers and the research, it was through supplementation, so not through whole food, but when you improve nutritional status in these prisoners, you reduced objective incidence of violence by 30%. And that the study that I was looking at was a replication of an earlier one. So at this point, there were kind of two or three studies in the area. And that was the point that I started to think, oh, okay, it was really relevant to what I was doing at the time. But also it really hooked into my own interest, my, you know, interest in food and liking being interested in cooking and all of that stuff. And it was kind of from then that I started to, you know, build on that, build on my knowledge, do additional training, and start to think about, well, if this is the impact that nutrition might be having in an acute phase, right? These studies were 8-12 weeks long, and we're seeing these outcomes. And they're RCTs. These weren't just kind of epidemiological observational data. They were comparing an intervention against a placebo, double blinded, some of them are triple blinded. So if this is the impact that nutrition can have in this brief amount of time, what is it doing over the long haul, over the lifespan or over a developmental period, whether we're talking about childhood or adolescence? What is it doing for us as we approach old age? And where is the information and evidence around that? So that's really, I think, where it started to come together.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, if you think about, and quite often, I mean, the prison population, unless, you know, there is a spotlight on, and was it women in prison specifically or just the prison population?
Yes, okay. It was. I was working in a women's prison.
Yeah, and I think unless we are focusing on rehabilitation and trying to reintegrate people into society, things like the study that you are describing are rarely ever given, they never see sunlight, do they? You know, they're never given the attention they deserve.
No, it's really astonishing, because if we were talking about, I think, any other population, if you were talking about children with ADHD, or if you were talking about older people with early signs of, say, dementia or Alzheimer's disease, if you were just talking about men with anger issues, right? You know, with men in the community who have anger problems, and you had an intervention that is low cost, accessible, you know, it's, you know, we're not going up a mountain to find a, you know, a sacred leaf, and low risk, you know, really there weren't any side effects, it's very safe. If we were talking about any other population, this would be groundbreaking research that would have been capitalized on. It would be part of a standard intervention. It would be part of frontline treatment. But I think because there is very little sympathy for this population, and I think also an unconscious desire to want to punish this population, that it becomes very difficult to utilize and to implement an intervention that appears to be just being nice to them, I think, or giving them something that perhaps other people don't have access to. And it's, whilst I can understand the impulse on a kind of unconscious level, I can understand the impulse, it's a very short-sighted, the cost-benefit analysis doesn't work. You know, just we would gain so much more through implementing this stuff than we do by not doing so.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, particularly, you know, when you think about some of the actions that we take. And I guess in a more trivial fashion, you know, when it comes to our personal finance decisions and that trade-off between short-termism versus long-termism, the extent to which we want to invest in our long-term financial futures versus this kind of YOLO mindset that seems to have gripped us, mm-hmm. you know, where we, you know, immediate gratification is the order of the day. And I talk about that quite a lot mm-hmm. in Cashy Screen. But I think you've articulated it so well, this idea that we do feel, and, you know, I don't hold myself up as, you know, a beacon of virtue where this is concerned. You know, we do all have this kind of subconscious mindset that says they are prisoners, they deserve to be punished. Why are we trying to give them haute cuisine in prison? Which, of course, isn't at all what we are talking about here, exactly mm-hmm. as you describe. If we're thinking about reintegrating the prison population into the wider population to live among us all, then it requires us to think about, well, what kinds of individuals do we want to emerge from prison? And it is that longer term yeah. view, you know, thinking about, well, if we invest in them today in some way, then that might give us the better chance of meaning that they are less likely to reoffend, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. As well as things like staff morale, reduced assaults on staff. You know, lots of people, staff are injured and they have to leave work and they're medically retired and all of this stuff. There are these wider kind of ripple effects of this kind of thing. But I think, yes, broadly, and I think around the conversation around nutrition is really about the difference between early investment for a long-term return on investment versus short-term, whether we call it gains or pleasure, you know, gains in terms of profit or immediate pleasure if we think about the individual basis.
So let's talk about that a bit more then, Kimberly, particularly with regards to, because I'm very interested in this idea of short-term investment and shorter term reward versus long term investment and longer term reward. It's something that we talk about, as I say, all the time at Raincheck. And I think in your work, and given all of the breadth of experiences that you've had already at this stage in your career, what kinds of, I suppose, that, I mean, maybe there are two parts to the question, but the first part is, you know, what would compel somebody to come and seek you out? What kinds of clients are you seeing routinely? Where are they coming from? Do you see, is it men more than women? Is it women more than men? Is it certain types of age groups? Where do these individuals come from, and how do they seek out your services in the first place?
So at the moment, my caseload is somewhere, is about 30% men, which is quite nice. It says that hopefully more broadly, men are finding it easier to seek out help and have a better attitude to help seeking than they have done in the past. Actually, I've got quite a broad range of ages. So I think I go from somewhere like 25 to 56. So quite a broad range. I think the people that find me now really are looking for something that feels a little bit more integrated. So they're people who have, and also I have a kind of, I have additional training in personality disorder. So there will be some people kind of seek me out for that. But they're broadly people who have perhaps heard a conversation or I've been spoken about in the context of, actually, have you thought about these other things that might be affecting the way that you feel? Or people who have perhaps been ill for a while, you know, feeling unwell or unhappy, unsatisfied for a long time, and they've tried lots of other therapy. You know, they've been in therapy for maybe 7-15 years, and it still quite hasn't hit right. They come with a feeling of, I think there's something that's been missing in my previous treatments. They've been helpful. I have taken away learnings from them that I've tried to implement, and or they kept me well for a while, but I think there was something missing. That tends to be the kind of group of people that will find me.
And so just thinking about some of the themes then that you cover in your book, and thinking specifically about brain health, because this is an area that, you know, for complete novice and somebody that comes from a non-clinical, non-scientific background, or even just somebody that has a clinical background that doesn't specialize in this area, anything to do with the brain is an absolute minefield. And, you know, it tends to be, our knowledge of it will tend to be pigeonholed around what we consider to be disorders or diseases that are predisposed to the elderly population, which actually we're seeing actually isn't the case, you know, with things like Alzheimer's and dementia, for example. Lots of us will have had experience of that within our own families. But for younger people, or just people in general, thinking about, well, what's the relationship between, we know that the relationship between brain and intellect, right? But the relationship between how we feel in general, you are giving it a focus and an energy and impetus that I don't think we've ever seen in the way that, you know, as I say, in the way that you articulate it, the way that you break it down. So can you just talk us through some of the pillars in your book around what the building blocks are towards brain health for anyone listening that's thinking, am I doing the right things even? I have no idea. What, you know, am I missing something?
Yeah.
What would you say?
And it would make sense for people to be confused, because it's this extraordinary oversight dichotomy, I don't know what to call it really, where the most important organ in the body, you know, the thing that is most complex and most in need of protection, is the one that we have the least amount of information on how to keep healthy, how to just look after, right? We teach children to brush their teeth, you know, from as early as possible, as soon as their teeth start to poke through, like, get on top of this. We tell people to not take up smoking or to quit smoking so that we can help prevent lung cancer. And yet, even though the leading causes of both illness, you know, like disability and death in the UK are brain related. So depression is a leading cause of disability, and dementia is a leading cause of death. So even though our leading causes of illness and disability and death are brain related, we have basically no public health policy on protecting the brain. And it's just, it's a very, very odd
situation. It's really odd. I mean, just to sorry to interrupt you just there, but I mean, even as you were talking, I thought to myself, you're quite right, because actually, if anyone were to ask the question, what would you, you know, to the average person, child or adult, what do you see as the number one organ in the body? We'd probably all say the heart.
And with that, if you ask people, you said, okay, well, if it's the heart, do you know how to look after your heart? I think most people would have some sense. They'd be like, oh yeah, yeah, I shouldn't eat too much salt, or I should exercise, or I, you know. So people would have some sense of what, you know, we have public and charity health campaigns about heart health. And yet, So in terms of building blocks or kind of key pillars, I think the first thing to say is that brain health is a long game. We are not talking about overnight success. We're not talking about a 3-month, 12-week body blitz. We're not, that's not where we're sitting with this. We're talking about really an organ that is constantly being shaped and remolded with experience every day. This conversation is shifting and changing my brain. You need to get on board that it's about the process and less about the outcome. So this is where we live in therapy. It's all about the process. I think one of the most, one of the quickest places you can start is nutrition, because you eat several times a day. And so there's an opportunity several times a day to consume something that is going to be supportive of your overall brain health, or less so. And the things and nutrients and foods that tend to be supportive of brain health, in particular, are things like DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, which is an omega-3 fatty acid. It's a very long-chain fat. It is a structural fat for the brain. It makes up part of your brain cell membrane. And it is a very special fat because it's very flexible. And you need that level of flexibility to give your cell membranes what's called fluidity, which allows kind of nutrients and amino acids and bits and pieces to come in and for toxins to be taken out efficiently. So it's a really important fat. It's an essential fat, which means your body can't synthesize it. You have to get it from the diet. And unfortunately, on a population level, hardly anybody in the UK is getting enough. We should be eating 2 portions of fish per week, of which one should be oily, your kind of salmon, trout, mackerel type fish. And we're getting somewhere around a portion, a large portion a month, a portion every 3 weeks. So we're falling very, very short on the recommendations. And those recommendations, 2 of which 1, were minimum standards. They were the ones like 5 a day. They were a number that was chosen because it seemed tolerable. It seemed, oh, this is something that was achievable. Right. When actually it should probably be a bit higher. And same with 5 a day. You should probably be aiming for something like 9 or 10. Some countries achieve 14.
Wow, yeah, exactly.
But they chose 5 because 5 feels A, achievable, and B, will give you, you know, benefits. So omega-3 fatty acids, leafy green vegetables is a really important one. A daily serving of leafy green vegetables is associated with slower brain aging to the degree that older people who had regular leafy greens had brains that were 11 years younger than their peers.
That's wild. Yes. Oh my gosh. You can't see my face, listeners, but I'm doing the classic dab shocked face. What?
So, and that's just a small serving, and a mix as much as possible. So mix up your spinach and your rocket and your collard greens and your spring greens and kale and all of those things. Mix them up. Try to eat them on a regular basis. And then brightly coloured vegetables like berries in particular, they help to keep the blood vessels in your brain, and this very hungry organ, your brain, needs a good blood supply to bring it the nutrients, the oxygen, the glucose that can help it to, you know, fuel that combustion, that level of metabolic activity. So berries provide compounds that help to keep those blood vessels nice and flexible, and they're associated in a very short amount of time, within 90 minutes, with improvements in things like test scores on memory, on accuracy, on cognitive flexibility. So we see very, very quick improvements with that. And then also fiber. Please, please eat lots more fiber, everyone, for lots of physical health reasons, but also because one of the byproducts of fiber metabolism are compounds called short-chain fatty acids, and they help to protect what's called the blood-brain barrier, which is this very selective, very important barrier that stops toxic compounds from crossing from your bloodstream into your brain. And again, on a population level, hardly anyone is eating enough fiber. So that is where I would say in terms of nutrition, sleep is absolutely crucial. Sleep is a cornerstone of brain health. If you don't get enough sleep over a long period of time, your brain can really start to break down. It can start to almost cannibalize itself, and instead of maintaining and repairing, it can start to break down synapses. So really try to address any sleep issues as soon as possible. Take your sleep very seriously. And then one of the most robust and well-demonstrated interventions for maintaining your brain health, including your brain volume, because your brain starts to shrink as you age. So from your, you know, depending on your baseline health, from your 40s, your 50s, your brain starts to shrink by about 0.5% per year. But we know that people who maintain physical exercise, regular physical activity, and that's both aerobic exercise and resistance exercise, are able to maintain and sometimes increase that brain volume. So that's really important, regular physical activity. And we mean consistency, not just, you know, going 4-hour treks on a weekend. 30 minutes a day, 5 times a week, would be a lovely kind of sweet spot. It's that consistency in physical activity that really helps to maintain brain connectivity and brain volume. And then there are a whole bunch
of
other
things. Honestly, even just as you were speaking, and there are lots of those things that I already do, not to be, you know, goody two shoes. There are lots of those things I already do. But even as you were speaking, I thought to myself, as somebody who has a lot of energy that I need to burn off anyway, the idea of physical exercise is an easy one for me to say, yes, I do that. Mm-hmm. And I've got 2 daughters, so I'm constantly thinking about their nutrition and wanting to make sure that there is the right balance in their nutrition. So, you know, even if they are, you know, on occasion, I'm a busy mom, so it might be like, well, you can have chips today because I can't, you can have chips and fish fingers. I can't think about it. I'm not cooking, you know, whatever I might ordinarily cook. And I'll go, I'm just going to sling in some broccoli because that'll make me feel good. That'll make me feel like I'm doing something, right?
Yeah.
But it makes me think, it occurs to me that for lots of us, everything that you said sounds brilliant, common sense, you know, as, you know, arguably the vast majority of people globally are thinking about, you know, well, actually I want to feel better, and I know that I don't feel good when I'm not getting enough sleep. You know, I'm sure there are moms around the world, even if you're not a mom, we know how we feel when we're groggy because we've been up all night. I mean, I remember, you know, in the early days of having newborns, feeling like I was hallucinating because of the lack of sleep, and it's horrific.
Yeah.
So we know all of these things, but the food, you know, even I remember, you know, the big 5-a-day campaigns or the talk about oily fish and things like that. As I say, it sounds like common sense, but why aren't we doing it? What are the things in your view that preclude us from doing this?
I think there are a lot of barriers, and I'll just lay them all out. It's like a pick
and
mix of problems.
And particularly for women, Kimberly, because I think, you know, what are the things, as women, you know, quite often we're the keepers of the household in many respects, whether our work is within the home exclusively or within the home and outside the home. Whatever the composition of our work portfolio looks like, we are still primarily keepers of the household. We manage the household purse and all of those sorts of things. So I'm interested in the things that stop us from actively engaging with this in the way that we would like.
Yes. So I think one of the things, if we start kind of broadly chronologically, is that the way that you eat in childhood tends to be stable. So it tends to be the way that you will continue to eat in adulthood. So it really matters about the access and opportunity to what we consider more nutritious foods early in life. And this is where we get a differential in terms of socioeconomic status, because what is true is that foods that tend to be nutrient poor, you know, your kind of processed, ultra processed foods, largely a lot of their ingredients, their constituents are subsidized. So things like oil, sunflower oil and seed oils, lots of wheat and cereal grains are subsidized for farmers. So those ingredients are very cheap, which means when your constituents are cheap, then you can make a very cheap product. And what that means is that calorie for calorie, an ultra processed or less healthy product is twice as cheap. It's half the price of a more nutrient dense diet. So for some people, right from the outset, they're going to be priced out of the opportunity to have a more nutrient dense diet. And if that's the trajectory, that's where you start, that's likely to be where you continue.
And that makes sense, because I think, I mean, quite often, and you can see this kind of red-faced rhetoric sometimes when you look in comment sections of some of those awful newspapers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll have people saying, you can get carrots for 12p in Lidl. You can buy a cabbage for 35p. There's no excuse. It's easier to eat healthier than it is to eat badly.
We know that people, the most deprived 20% of the UK population, would need to spend 50% of their disposable income just to meet the government's Eat Well guidelines. Whilst for the wealthiest 20%, that's just 11% of their disposable income. So, and when we say disposable income, there isn't really that much of that around at the moment when we've got high oil prices, increasing food prices, energy prices, cost of transport, trains, all of this. So you've got a 40% differential in the availability, the kind of economic accessibility of a nutritious diet. So we can't call it choice when people literally can't afford the healthier option. So there's those things. And then within that, there's also the marketing. So one of the examples that I put in Unprocessed is that the recommendation for young children, toddlers, 1 and 2 years old, is that they shouldn't have any free sugar in their diets. They don't need it. They get enough energy, and they can, in fact, you know, everyone could probably get enough glucose from whole foods, from cereals and whole grains, and, you know, their bodies can break it up to provide sufficient energy. But something like a rusk, you know, a Farley's rusk biscuit, which is advertised as an ideal first food, a weaning food, a lovely, soft textured, delicious biscuit that will keep your child quiet whilst you try and get on with something, is 30% sugar. Parents are being marketed, and something like over 90% of foods that are marketed for children come with a health claim on the front, which makes it seem more nutritious or a better option than something else that might be a simpler food or a simpler food product. So there's a whole world of marketing, which makes it difficult and very confusing for consumers to be able to understand what is probably the best thing for my child, what is going to be the most nutritious thing. Then we have the demands of time. Everybody's busy. And actually, these foods which are heavily marketed come with a message of convenience and ease, and it makes life easier for you, and you don't have to think about it. And that's a broader social question, which is about how do we ensure that families have enough time to cook and eat together? Because that is something, again, that's outside of people's hands. If you are working very, very long hours or a couple of different jobs, if you are trying to pay for childcare, which is extortionate,
yes. I mean, it's a whole conversation in itself.
Something has to give. And often the thing that can give, because all of everything else is a fixed cost, you know, your rent or your mortgage, the thing that gives is the food bill. And therefore you're pushed towards the cheaper, heavily subsidized in production, but less nutritious foods. So there is a whole world of barriers that are outside of people's hands, which is where this kind of red face, your people are making poor choices kind of rhetoric is just very, very misguided, if not outright cruel.
And I'm, you know, as you're talking, you know, I'm nodding along. I'm sure that there are a number of listeners that are nodding along, particularly when you talk about, you know, cost of living crisis, you know, inflationary mm-hmm. food prices, but also, you know, this lack of time and the idea that, you know, do I actually have the time mm-hmm. to, you know, get from work at 6:30 and then cook down a lovely pot of lentils and, you know, I just don't have the time for that versus, you know what, I'll just grab something from M&S on the way. Don't get me wrong, love M&S, miss M&S dearly. But the point is, you know, that when you look at that trade-off in terms of your long-term health, and the thing that's interesting in what you say is about that trajectory as, you know, these things, which would make sense, you know, being rooted in childhood. And then, you know, you stay on that course. It's a very similar principle when we talk about where some of our money habits and behaviours come from. We know that study that points to, you know, children forming their earliest money habits from the age of 7. It doesn't mean that they are immutable, they can't be changed, but it does mean that, you know, we're starting to form ideas about what's the relationship between my happiness and money, for example. What's the relationship between work and money and where I might get money from and all of these sorts of things and the relationship between that then and our mental well-being. So we know that if you're coming from a background, you know, you talked about socioeconomic status and the extent to which many of us are able to break out of the ones within which to which we were born.
Which is really hard, again, in the UK, because we have the most stagnant social mobility in Europe. So it's very difficult. Some of us can, but we shouldn't assume that just because there are a handful of people who do, that it's just easy and that it's just an outcome of effort, because actually what the data indicates is that those who are born in the lowest SES stay there. And similarly, those who are born at the top, they don't drop down. They are staying at the top. So much of this, and this is why I talk, my first book was really about kind of self-help, and this is what you can do, and this is what's in your hands. And the second one was really like, well, actually, here is the part that isn't in your hands. This is the part that is policy. This is the part that is the food environment and the access that your family had to nutritious food, or whether you lived in a food desert because of your family's income, or whether you had access to healthcare and a green space to run around in, whether your parents could afford childcare, or, you know, all of those things. That is policy. And we need that combination of proactive, preventative, and I think magnanimous policy, public health policy, along with individual change, education, and self-responsibility, you know, personal responsibility.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm recording this from the Caribbean, and just thinking about the food situation here, of course, when people think about the Caribbean, you know, you think of abundance. Well, of course, you know, first of all, if you're not somebody that's familiar with the Caribbean, perhaps through heritage or, you know, having visited, first of all, you might be thinking, you know, beautiful beaches, you know, this island idyll. For people that live here, of course, you know, in the same way as you would think of anywhere, you know, it's you have your day-to-day grind and struggle and whatever else. One of the biggest challenges facing this region is food security and that imbalance in terms of import versus export. You know, this particular island has a particular abundance of fresh produce, of course, and, you know, amazing food, whole foods that can be grown in your back garden. But what we've seen, and this is why, you know, everything that you say about public health really resonates, is that what we see is a predisposition, particularly among the younger population, towards fast food, towards you know, highly processed foods, over the fresh produce that is growing in their back garden, for example. And of course, I'm generalizing this, but again, these are policy decisions and education, the results of, you know, perhaps a lack of, I don't know, kind of wide scale education programs designed to target people, perhaps when they're in school. It doesn't mean that these things aren't happening. Absolutely, they happen in the same ways they happen in the UK. But to what extent does it resonate with the population so that they think to themselves, actually, I have within my grasp the opportunity to transform how I'm eating and therefore to transform my longer term health outcomes? So it really is interesting to think about it from that perspective, because actually out here, in contrast to other parts of the world, the UK in particular, it's arguably cheaper to live off the land, as they say, and to have the vast majority of your diet composed of things that you grow yourself. But people will instead, in a number of cases, prefer to choose fast food options. Now, of course, for some of the contributory factors you've outlined, absolutely apply here. It's time. People are working quite often two jobs, three jobs. They're busy. That, you know, they lots of children in a household in some cases, and so you just think, actually, even if it costs me more, it's easier for me to just buy food from somebody that sells it. I have no idea of the salt level, the sugar level, the fat and all of those sorts of things, but it's just easier. So, yeah, it really is almost something that requires just greater investment across the board.
It requires greater investment, but I think it also requires really a kind of valuing of the incumbent food culture. Because what we see around the world is a kind of sprawling westernization or industrialization of the food culture. And that, again, that comes down to policy and how much these industrial manufacturers are allowed to advertise, promote, subsidize, you know, put on special their foods, whether they're allowed to track young people and their advertising on social media to promote a certain type of food. But also really how much the individual culture community or country values its food culture, because you see some where they really have worked very hard to protect it. I think France has a very strong set of regulations on all parts of French culture. You know, I think a number, it certainly used to be the case that a certain number of songs in the charts had to be sung in French. They had to be French language songs. And that there's a real valuing of the, you know, the bread culture and the history of cheese making, and you know, that a lot of the policies from the EU arrive from actually what do we consider to be real food. I was at a restaurant, and it was like an American style like steak restaurant, and they're like, oh, in America we have this kind of cheese sauce, but we have to make our own here because the EU won't let us import it because they don't consider it cheese, they don't consider it food. So, you know, there are you know, the protections around what is considered food and a valuing of the incumbent food culture is also part of the conversation. You know, seeing what you have as valuable and worth and meaningful, you know. And I think what happened, for example, with Italian peasant cucina is, you know, it was called cucina povera, you know, just a food of the poor, but it was really it was seen as beautiful, humble, delicious, simple. It was really seen as a beautiful representation of what it could mean to eat well off the land, whereas in the UK, you know, there was a great history of things like seafood and oysters and welts and mussels and of, you know, beans and all of those sorts of things. But they were looked down upon as poor food. And there was a real class issue. You know, it was kind of seen as food of the poor, and we aspire to be middle class. And so we dismiss that and we move towards these foods that are advertised as aspirational. And so that, I think that comes into it as well. What do we aspire to? What are we sold as the goal, as a kind of sense of the value and an important thing to be and to consume?
I love that, Kimberly. I mean, I could talk to you about this particular subject all day, and I'm so interested. I mean, there is so much that I'm sure, you know, people have their own perspectives on France and its legal system and some of the things that they do well, some of the things they do less well, but certainly the way that they are fiercely protective of their value system, their culture, their heritage and their history is something that I think, you know, worldwide we could look to as a kind of, as almost gold standard. It's not the only one, of course, but in terms mm-hmm. of particularly around food. And I think that really makes a difference. So, oh, thank you for that. Thank you for that snapshot, because I think it really is part of the solution for sure. I want to bring it back to thinking more about money and mental health, because one of the things, I mean, I could turn this into a whole public health policy podcast and talking about food, because it's something that I absolutely love. I think for the purposes of this podcast, you know, one of the things that when RainCheck first started, and RainCheck is about to be 5 years old, and I was particularly keen to stress the relationship between money and mental health, or at least to amplify the importance of investing in your financial well-being alongside all other pillars of your well-being. So I always said, you know, financial well-being is as much a part of your holistic well-being as your physical well-being, your mental well-being, because we know the interdependency between all of these pillars. What sorts of things are you seeing, you know, from a clinical perspective? How does it present? Because we know, you know, again, thinking about the last 3 years and now, you know, we've kind of lurched straight into a cost of living crisis, which compounds the issue. How does it show up for you among your client base or just in general?
I think people are worried, and people are thinking about... What's really interesting is one of the things, one of the issues about the real complexities around money and mental health is how important it is to be able to make plans. Because making plans, being able to make plans, gives you a sense of agency over your life. You feel as if you have control, you can choose, and you know what's going to happen. And without that, what happens is that you get this emergence of uncertainty, and the brain hates uncertainty. Your brain finds uncertainty very, very stressful to the degree that your brain will prefer a definite negative over uncertainty. And that's when we find ourselves kind of catastrophizing, or, you know, even if it's something like, you send a message to a friend and they haven't messaged you back and everything is probably fine. You have no reason to think that there's anything happening, but where your mind goes is, oh, I've done something to upset them. They hate me. I've been... Because your mind prefers a definite negative. It cannot bear the uncertainty. And so the issue at the moment is that when people are on insecure contracts, so whether it's kind of gig economy or short-term contracts, which is like what I see more of, you know, people are, you're on a three-month, six-month contract. Okay, so I've got money for the next 3 or 6 months and then I don't know what's happening. And of course, you know, redundancies can happen at any point in a career, but being able to broadly have a sense of this is secure and safe and I can make plans allows you to kind of settle and creates a kind of freedom of mind to be able to think about other things. You know, if I know that there's some money coming in, then I can think about something else. And when you don't have that security, you worry, you ruminate, and it kind of takes over your thinking, it takes over your mind, and it's incredibly stressful. So money worries become, they can really corrode mental health in a very, very profound way. I'm seeing people really having, feeling very anxious about whether they're able to get another job. And then that comes into, brings into question whether they can continue having therapy or, you know, the thing that is helping them to feel better, whether that becomes inaccessible to them. A lot of hopelessness, actually. People say, people feeling as though the odds are stacked against them. Because they, I think particularly at the moment where there seems to be a real differential between those in power and in the UK, we have the wealthiest ever prime minister and widening social inequality, a reduction in real terms, wages, benefits, you know, reductions in the now kind of restricting the support that will go to humanities, university courses, all sorts of things. And people are starting to think, actually, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing in my power that I can do to improve my odds because the game is rigged. And that's a very, very, it's a difficult situation to kind of handle in therapy because one of the things you must also always be careful to do as a practitioner is to not hold the individual responsible for harms that have been done to them by society or by the environment. And so there's a way in which, you know, if someone comes with a sense of despondency, we can explore and we can say, you know, are you thinking about this the right way? Are you being unnecessarily pessimistic? Or is there another way? Can we reframe the way you're thinking about this issue? And sometimes that's absolutely appropriate, but also sometimes it's really appropriate to say, actually, things are really bad now, and this isn't you. This is the reality of the situation, and your despondency, your sadness, your frustration, your rage, whatever it is appropriate to what you're experiencing. So trying to hold those things in balance is difficult, and it's more of what I'm having to do at the moment.
Mm. I like the idea of, because you said earlier in the conversation that, you know, as therapy goers, we are quickly trying to find the solution. So we go to therapy because, and we're like, what's fix me, give me the answer, because I haven't got time actually. So I've got an hour with you today. Quickly tell me what is the problem with me so that I can sort it out and I can bounce. And so, you know, even opening up this conversation, you know, that snippet that you shared, you know, however whimsical it sounds, and it's so relevant to now. If you message someone, you expect an immediate response. Why are you taking 3 minutes to respond? Or why can I see that you're typing and then you stopped typing? Where have you gone? Answer within like 5 seconds. Otherwise, I think you hate me. So, you know, what you described about, you know, our brains actually not being able to, that actually makes a lot of sense. Our brains not being able to process that uncertainty. So we would rather the worst case scenario, because then we're like, right, I'm going to plan for the worst case scenario. That's okay.
Yes.
I'm going to lose my job. So I'm going to plan for that. And then you constantly live with those, I mean, that stress hormone just rushing around your body. And you will know that better than, you know, my reading of magazines and understanding of cortisol and how that works. But, you know, feeling constantly on edge and how that shows up for people. You know, I have a whole raft of women at different life stages, you know, some who are in, you know, happy, well-balanced relationships, but still they're thinking, you know, well, if my partner leaves me, then I've got to plan for that eventuality. or you've got women that are maybe divorced and they're thinking, right, I've got to think about all of these sorts of things and the economic implications of that. Rightly, that, you know, of course it changes things. Or women that come to me and say, oh, I'm X age and I should have a pension and I haven't got enough in my pension, or I don't know if I've got enough in my pension. Mm. They may actually have a really well-funded pension. They have no idea. And so it's easy for our minds when you hear the, you know, all of the negative rhetoric around pension planning and the fact that, you know, as women, actually there is this gap and we do need to invest in our pension planning on a long-term basis. Mm. But there are lots of us that might think, oh, well, it's too late, so there's no point. And so it can be useful to speak to an expert like you who can say, actually, the broader landscape is crap, actually, for lots of us. and it's not you. It's not you. This is an institutional level. It's a broader social or economic level. These are some of the things that you can do day to day to just help to calm your mind, soothe your mind. And it's the building blocks approach again, exactly as you described with nutrition. You know, what are some of the micro steps that you can take to make a contribution?
But also on that, you know, this idea of, I found myself saying, it's not you, it's London, because where my practice is based, because women in particular will come to me and they will ask me why they're not successful enough in every possible realm of their life. And they will list them. They will list them.
Yeah, of course,
they
we love a list.
I should have bought a house by now. I should be able to afford the house I want. I should have more friends than I have right now. I should have a big group of glossy friends.
That adore me.
And we should all... and we should have all be able to afford to go to brunch every weekend, and I should be in shape, and probably that should have been achieved with the help of a personal trainer or some very expensive gym. I should be on top of my nutrition. I should either be engaged or married, and I should be able to afford the wedding, the destination wedding, like all of this. And I literally have to say, these are unreasonable expectations for a single human life. Because we have to, one of the, I think, idiosyncratic side effects of the opportunity to do more is the belief that we have to do everything. And those are two very, very different things. You can do everything, you know, in as far as you have the opportunity to learn to play the harp, to go climbing, to, you know, start a side hustle as a taco restaurant, whatever. Like, you have those opportunities, but you do not have the time to do them all. That is a finite, you know, universal limit. And I think what happens is that we, and whether that's about internal human nature, or whether that's about what we're sold, there isn't this ability to tolerate the possibility that I can't do it all without feeling like a failure. You know, and I really have to have sometimes quite difficult conversations with people, because I think they feel like I'm giving up on them, or I'm being unnecessarily pessimistic, or I'm not being ambitious enough for them. But really what I'm saying is, you have to choose. You know, if you want to be CEO of a thriving business, what that needs, what that demands is a lot of time. It demands a lot of time, a lot of energy and focus. And if you are putting that time, energy and focus into that, I'm afraid you're unlikely to be as hands-on a parent as you would like to be, because raising a child takes a lot of time and energy and focus. Or what I mean, that tends to be the two main competing demands. There may be others, but caring for parents, that kind of education, whatever. And I have to say to people, you have to choose where you can tolerate being mediocre. And that is not a conversation.
Wow, it's like you've got punches, isn't it? Especially for women. Mediocre? What are you talking about? Haven't you seen my list? What? We don't do mediocrity over here.
No, we don't. No. And then someone else will say, well, Beyonce has 24 hours, 20 hours. Right? And it's that. You have to choose. I'm really sorry. But unless you want to burn out, make yourself sick, collapse, and in which case you will fail at everything, you have to choose what is going to get more energy and therefore what is going to flourish more in the way, in the direction you want it to, and what will not. And then what we can work on is how you tolerate not being the best in those other realms, because that is life. That is human life. You can be fantastic in one realm, but you've got to be able to bear the disappointment, the loss of opportunity, of not being the all-star in these other realms of your life.
Wow. Embracing mediocrity. I'm not joking. It really felt like a gut punch even to me. And I'm like, it's nothing to do with me. And I'm like, oh, why did she say that?
Sorry.
So Kimberly, I recognize that we have a few, as I say, I feel like this could be like a whole 5 hour long conversation, but I'm interested in your relationship with money and how that's evolved over time. Mm. And I suppose in particular, given what you said about embracing mediocrity and with all of your training as a clinical practitioner, what does it mean? What does wealth look like for you? You know, how, you know, thinking about your relationship with money and how you approach your own personal finances, how does wealth show up for you in your life, would you say? Is it an ongoing journey? Is it something that you say there was a particular moment of truth that, you know, has changed things?
I think on the, what comes to mind when you say a moment of truth, but I think what my vocation has afforded me is knowing the difference between having money and being wealthy. And I have, not just in my work, in my life, I have encountered a lot of people who on paper have a lot of money. They have a, you know, they have millions in the bank, but they live a very impoverished life. They live a life where their relationships are unsatisfactory. And that might be because they're a workaholic. The reason they have a lot of money is because they're a workaholic, but that leaves them no time or energy to invest in their relationships. Or they find it very difficult. They're so afraid of rejection that they find it difficult to, you know, take the risk of entering a relationship in a complete and honest way that you need to. Or they are full of regret, and they are full of regret that consumes them on a daily basis. They can't leave it in the past. They live every day. It's like that song, Good Morning Heartache. They greet it every morning, you know, loss. They haven't been able to let it go and grieve it so that they can move on. And so I think that is something that I have been able to, I hope, really take in and pay attention to. And so my wealth for me, wealth specifically for me is agency. I know that I don't do well being told what to do.
Same.
There is a reason that I work for myself.
Same. I feel bad for all of my former bosses, but I use charm to get over the fact that I'm entirely willful.
Honestly. So for me, wealth is agency. And that means being able to choose what I do with my time. That feels like wealth to me. And I, you know, I certainly could be earning more. I could be doing more things to be earning more money, but then I would have less time. And I know I really value time. I really value time. So that's where I've chosen, or, you know, I've selected my mediocrity. I could be earning more. I have to bear the fact that I'm not earning more because it means I have more time to do whatever else I want to do. And also to really, really, really value my relationships and to really, and that is an onward, ongoing process. You know, to not be neglectful, to not be the friend that doesn't message back, to make sure that I'm trying to find ways every week to make sure that I'm having some kind of social engagement, to make real deliberate investment in community. So not just friendships, but community as well. Am I part of my local community rather than just a visitor? You know, I come home, go to bed, and then get up and leave my house. That for me is a kind of interpersonal relational wealth, and I really want to keep trying to build that.
I love that. And I love, I mean, if there was almost a message for the listeners, and you've touched on it again there, and I'm honestly, since you said it, I'm like, oh God, which one, what am I going to choose? But it's, you know, we have to choose our mediocrity. So I think, you know, we talk all the time about the opportunity cost, of course, within the context of the Rainmakers Academy and Raincheck, and thinking, you know, if you choose option A versus option B, recognize there's a trade-off, but make peace with whichever option you choose, and know that for whichever option, there is a price to be paid. Are you willing to pay the price? And we have to be willing to pay that price. So thank you for putting it, to just stripping off. You stripped it completely naked. We're standing exposed in the street. We are choosing our mediocrity, listeners. We have to choose it. So, Kimberly, thank you so much for your time today. I'm mindful that we are out of time. Where can people find you, work with you, find out more, follow you? As I say, Kimberly has a brilliant, a truly brilliant Instagram channel. And as I say, she has a real gift for articulating some incredibly complex principles, theories, nuggets of information in a really just simple but fun way. So I would definitely start there. But Kimberly, where else?
Yes, no, I think Instagram is probably the best place at the moment. So that's at Food and Psych. Otherwise, I have a website. It's kimberlywilson.co, and that's Kimberly with an L-E-Y. And you can find everything there. And I have just fired up my LinkedIn again. So
I love that. I'll connect with you there. Kimberly, thank you so, so much for your time today. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how RainCheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips, and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at RainCheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review, and subscribe. See you next time.